we will deal, let's say, with the dialectic of individual and group. An individual in a family, but the family as a constellation, a group. You know, what I want to ask you is, when you hear the word family, you know, what are some things that triggers in your mind? What are some images or metaphors, and particularly family as a group?
My kids.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Holidays. Yeah.
Pardon?
Holidays.
Holidays. Oh, that's great. Generation distinctions.
One house.
Right?
Or one group.
A household.
Yeah,
household. Okay. Family.
Certain structures or relationships that are different from relationships that you have with other people.
Okay. Family is here, and we have these kinds of relationships, and with others we act differently.
Yeah, you assume something about family.
Okay. It's kind of like it's all right if you take peas on a spoon at supper time at home, but when you're, you know, at the boss's house or a restaurant, that's a no-no. That's good. We'll touch base with some of those as we go along. What I have in mind is to introduce, let's say, some ideas, some concepts, some way of viewing the family and viewing the family's functioning. I'll attempt to illustrate some of that with the book Ordinary People, which you discussed last week, and the movie, which most of us saw. I haven't read the book. I saw a movie twice. As I paged through the book, just sentence after sentence jumped out as this is a clear illustration of such and such concept. And so now I wish I'd read the whole book, then we could have unpacked the whole thing with Ordinary People. I see it as a tremendous illustration, and in that sense, the title is very appropriate. These were indeed ordinary people, as the author characterized them. Real brief background about family systems and how we get to family systems, and maybe where we've been in our thinking, especially in the area of psychology, social work. Classic psychology in our era is with Freud. And the image, the stereotype of Freudian psychology is you have somebody reclining on a couch, and the psychiatrist sits in a chair above the person's head, which means they're out of view. The idea is that the client here is the individual, and in the psychiatrist's office, the attempt is to have an uncontaminated atmosphere. It's like going into a lab and isolating something on under a microscope. Very few questions are asked, and the person just relates whatever comes to mind. That's come under quite a bit of criticism, that people who really get better after prolonged and intensive psychiatric work, the statistics are that the incidence isn't any greater than spontaneous remission or spontaneous improvement over the course of time. If people just left alone get as much better as the people who spend $75 an hour 5 days a week for 7, 9, 12 years. So you see, you don't need to be in that tax bracket to have the benefit. Isn't that nice? That was popularized in many ways by Carl Rogers. He's the big name in this area. And now we're talking about the early and mid 1950s. Client-centered therapy, Carl Rogers' book, I think, is copyright 54. He engages the client. He has a lot of this uh-huh and I see. Again, really the focus is on the client, and Rogers is very much claims to be, wants to be out of the picture. But people who study tapes of his work and watch him work notice that when he says, uh-huh, I see, whatever the client was talking about, they keep talking about. and things that he doesn't respond to, those topics fall by the side. So he really does stack the deck. His presence is very much a part of the process. About the same time, there's a group of people in California who are studying communication theory, and they are studying it in the context of schizophrenia. What happens in schizophrenic families or families where there's a schizophrenic person? And they are running the hypothesis that it's not genetic, that it's not a matter of nutrition, it's a matter of communication and interpersonal interaction. So again, the schizophrenic as an individual is seen in the context of family, and their being schizophrenic is not just their problem, but there's family involvement in that setting. So Don Jackson and Jay Haley and Paul Watzkiewicz and some others are studying it and producing papers, and their big thing is the double bind. It's like a parent saying to a child, well, you do what's best for you and somehow I'll manage. You know, which says, do your own thing at the beginning, but then says, well, don't do it because it's going to hurt me. And so whatever you do, you're wrong. If you do your own thing, I suffer. If you stay home and to keep me from suffering, if you do what I want you to do instead of what you want to do so I don't suffer, then you're not affirming yourself and you're not growing up and you're not becoming mature, and that's wrong. So you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. It's a double bind. An exceedingly commonplace, it's the rule, it's the norm of interaction in schizophrenic families. Person becomes, a youngster, cannot function over long term in that kind of a setting. They can't cope with that world which doesn't allow them to win and doesn't affirm them, and so they create their own world, and they, you know, escape off into that world, and they live in that world, and then they lost touch with the quote-unquote real world. That's a real simplistic presentation of it. But the point that I'm trying to make is the shift of the classical Freudian thing of looking at an individual, that the idea even that we could isolate an individual outside of their environment and really have something, someone. The shift from that to looking at things collectively. A major name in the area is Murray Bowen, who in the late 60s went to a national convention of psychiatrists and presented a paper, but instead of presenting some kind of an academic paper, what he did was to tell his own story of going home, but he didn't use any first-person pronouns, and yet it became rather clear within a few paragraphs that he was really talking about himself. I wasn't there, but the audience, so I understand, became exceedingly nervous and anxious because he was bringing the stuff home in our midst, and himself being real, and it wasn't safe, academic, remote type setting that they were anticipating. So it comes towards the family as a group, and then I want to present some of that material. That's a little bit of how we got there. An image that I use for the family is a mobile. You know, these things that you hang over a crib or in your room, a string and a few pieces of wire or sticks and other strings and different pieces on there of weights and colors and distances from the center. And it is in balance. Homeostasis. The system has some kind of an equilibrium and it stays in that position. If you move any one of those pieces, if you remove it, you make it further out on the stick or closer in, you add weight, you subtract weight, the whole thing shifts. So if something is done to an individual in a family, if some change happens, somebody leaves, somebody grows up, somebody gets married, somebody starts school, somebody becomes an alcoholic, somebody gets a job, loses a job, whatever happens, that there's a shift, significant shift with an individual, there's a shift with the family. To the extent that the shift is by choice, on that individual's part. The family is more dynamic than a mobile, in that a mobile simply shifts, finds a new balance, and lets it be. The family realizes that a new shift is threatened, is attempted, is pushed for, and they respond by trying to get it back the way it was, to get it back to the homeostasis, the comfortable arrangement that we had before this change occurred. Good illustration of that, it's a rather typical one, is the alcoholic who becomes dry, goes in for treatment, comes back home, and within a couple of months is an alcoholic again drinking. The family couldn't make the adjustment or resisted the adjustment to the change in their behavior because of the implications it had, a change in the alcoholic's behavior of not drinking anymore and related behaviors. Family resisting changes in themselves. I mean, if the alcoholic isn't coming home drunk, then somebody can't yell at them and blame them and accuse them, so the other people have to find other ways of relating. That's change, that's new, and that's resisted. And so it's very frequent that family will manage to sabotage the dry alcoholic so they become wet again. Okay, so the mobile as the family is a mobile, but very much dynamic. First quarter of clinical pastoral education I had was at Abbott Northwestern Hospital in Minneapolis. One area of involvement was open heart surgery, but because I had a graduate degree in psychology, I was involved in the psychiatric unit. And they hadn't had a chaplain there previously, and they weren't sure what they were going to do with a chaplain, but with a degree in psychology, they thought they knew how they were going to involve me, so I wound up being like co-therapist in group therapy, involved in some intake interviews. Well, it was a real jolt for me, that experience, because, for example, one fellow came in who had attempted suicide, slashed his wrists, and dove off the end of the dock on a lake in Minneapolis, lots of lakes there. So they managed to pull him out, and he was in the hospital, and the psychiatrist had prescribed shock treatment. They shave the scalp, take the person on a cart down the hallway, hook wires up to their head, and you know, push the lever and give them a good, you know, scrambled eggs for brains. And that was a jolt for me, because I thought that went out with the Middle Ages. Well, I learned that this individual was set up for shock treatment, and then went in and met with him, his wife, and three children. And this was, you know, within a couple of hours of his arrival at the hospital. And I listened to them, and I interacted with them, and I asked some questions, and I watched their interacting with each other. And it was very clear to me that if I were that fellow, I'd probably done the same thing. I mean, that whole family was nuts, and their way of interacting was scrambled eggs. So I was rather disturbed by that, and I went in and talked to the psychiatrist, and I said, you know, I really don't understand why you are treating this man this way. Really, what's being accomplished? And he said, well, you know, our doing this is going to keep him out of the obituary column. And I said, well, that's fine, we'll keep him out of the obituary column, but when we're done with him here at the hospital, we're going to send him back to the home with these people, and we haven't done anything with them. It's the same environment, same patterns of interaction, and he's going to be back in the hospital. And the shrink said, psychiatrist said, well, that's right, but we're going to keep him out of the obituary column. So he was kind of acknowledging that it was not a cure, it was only a stopgap measure. And he was saying, but that's all that we can do. We really can't get the family in. Doing that is very difficult, and it's very expensive, and just not practical. It may be, in one sense, the right thing to do, but it's not a practical thing to do. Without treating the family, there was no cure for that individual. So some of the dynamic. Systems theory has been developing not only in psychology, but in the social sciences, in mathematics, in physics, biology, business administration, you name it. The perspective of the social unit is catching on strong, and sociologists have been keen on that. And some of you last week indicated that you've heard about it, systems theory, from other fields of study. Yeah, that looks pretty good. Systems would be appropriate for families. For your work here, or some aspect of it, it's appropriate to think of congregations as a system, or a group of systems, or a system of systems. And you could think of Holden Village in a systemic way. So, some of the terms in kind of looking now at this illustration, in part, who was it? John last week, I think, said, "Well, I learned a new word: differentiation." The term differentiation is talking about the process of an individual becoming a separate individual, no longer simply being a member of the family unit. A young infant has a name. In baptism, they are acknowledged as someone separate, and they are acknowledged as belonging to somebody other than the family. But very much dependent on the whole system and enmeshed with the system. Young children tend to be quite enmeshed with the system. What the system, what the family stands for, is what the child is taught to stand for. What mother and father and older siblings approve of, the youngster is expected to approve of, and what parents disapprove of, without anybody really saying so, youngsters also to disapprove of that. Enmeshment means there's no distance whatsoever. What you think, I think. What you approve of, I approve of. What you're interested in, I'm interested in. And emotional enmeshment just allows for no distinction. The opposite of enmeshment would be distance. That is such separateness that there is very little interaction. You think whatever you want to think, and I'll think whatever I want to think, and we're going to stay away from each other as much as we possibly can. Differentiation would be in between that, where the individual can think some of their own thoughts, but interact in interdependent ways with other members of the family. Let's see, another way to illustrate that is to say that enmeshment means the youngster grows up to be a carbon copy of one parent or the other. Now, it slightly overstates it, but to illustrate it. So the youngster of an alcoholic grows up and is an alcoholic. Distance can be seen by the one who grows up and is 180 degrees different than the parent. So if the parent's an alcoholic, youngster grows up to be a teetotaler. In neither case is there differentiation. You know, the person who thinks they're free, who claims to be free, but is exactly the opposite of the person they want to be free from, is not free from that person. Because whatever that person is defines who I am, because I'm exactly 180 degrees opposite. So who I am and my being 180 degrees opposite is keyed to who they are. The person who goes off at 70 degrees or 32 degrees or 46, 56, whatever, and does their own thing, is really doing their own thing and making choices on their own. Carbon copy and the direct opposite are very much enmeshed with and defined by who the person is that they're copying or rebelling against. So differentiation, interdependent, interacting with the family. Herb Anderson has a volume that is unfortunately titled, that's Family and Pastoral Care. You know, this certainly would be a good book to read with ordinary people, and would even be a good part of the program, and it would sell better if it were the family and ministry. So you have lay ministry and ordained ministry involved. He taught at Wartburg Seminary. This is published by Fortress. He presents family systems, and he combines it with theology. His combination is a first article combination. So he starts with creation, creation theology, and then weaves that together with family systems. And his favorite word in there is being separate together. As a differentiated individual who's yet part of interdependently interacting with a family. The family together, the individual separate. Being separate together. Alana?
Is that philosophy of family systems taught mostly through pastoral care and counseling in
no.
the seminaries? No.
No, the family systems. Well, let's see. I would say family systems was pretty well not mentioned at all when I was at seminary, but Murray Bowen's paper is 1969. Family systems per se, with that title and developing the literature, really wasn't well underway till the mid-70s and later. And I finished seminary in 78. I started in 73 or something like that. So when I was at seminary, the people who were teaching hadn't been trained in that. Herb Anderson's not a very old person, and so his training is more recent. His teaching is influenced that way. And so I think that's still new. I imagine you go to seminary now, you'd find it in all the Lutheran seminaries. That's my guess. Yeah. But family systems as the expression of pastoral care, or family systems as a subsection under pastoral care, is not correct. Family systems is taught by people who have nothing to do with pastoral care. So, separate in that way. Oh, let's see. Yeah, one way of seeing some of that is when I do premarital relationship work. Let's say I was meeting with Cal and Beth when they were first engaged and they hadn't gotten married yet. And I do one of these genograms, and I'd have Cal's family up here and Beth's over here, and then we'd talk about some of the things I'm about to present. It seems inevitable, and the longer that the process is discussed, the more it seems that the person that Cal is engaged to is very similar emotionally and in his interaction with her. She is very similar to Cal's mother. And Cal is very similar to Beth's father. I'm not trying to say that out of ordinary people. I'm trying to just illustrate something. So the family in which we grow up, the family where we learn how to interact with other people, family where we have very significant relationships, and the family where we identify who we are, we carry that homeostasis, that mobile, that balance, we carry it from that family, our position in that family, to our position in the family that we design, so to speak, except that we maintain, if I can hold the imagery, we maintain our position in the new mobile and look for a spouse figure who will maintain his or her position out of his or her mobile, but it's also supposed to be out of the position that the spouse has and the one I grew up in. I don't know if that was very clear. I'm trying to be generic there. Whatever wifey model Cal's mother had, his wifey's going to follow suit. Beth's experience of what hubby's role is in marriage, she goes and looks for a hubby who does that sort of thing. At the same time, whatever unfinished business is going on here, She looks for somebody with whom to finish that. Whatever unfinished business is going on between Cal and his mother, he looks for somebody with whom to finish that. But not intentionally, not self-consciously, it just happens that way. And that etiology of a great deal of tension in marriage relationships, because the partners are trying to resolve agendas with the other person that really isn't with the other person. It stems from some other relationship, and you cannot solve here a problem that's over here or over here. So it gets to be rather interesting to watch. Well, maybe that's jumping ahead slightly. So let me go back to some of these other terms. Let's see, one other term, and then I'll unpack the list that I gave you. As triangles. How many read that section in Family Ties talking about triangles? If you were to look at this family and think about triangles, what were some of the triangles in ordinary people? Where?
Surely Cal, Beth, and Con.
Okay, Cal, Beth, and Con. And what was the configuration of that? Who got along with whom and who didn't get along?
Dad and son.
Okay, dad and son got along.
Better than the other. They had conflicts too, but...
So we'll...
They were the two best sides getting along in contest.
Okay, these two got along. And Beth and Con, it was what?
Conflict.
Okay, this is conflict. And Beth and Kel was what?
Conflict.
Yeah, this was conflict. It was kind of conflict at a distance in many ways.
Mm.
You know, they were polite enemies, usually. Especially, you know, you go to a party, you keep up a good image. So they tended to keep up something of an image. But so that was one triangle. What's another one?
Is that burger? That's the shrink?
Okay.
And Con was a triangle with his dad. Could you stretch it that far?
Well, you could.
Yeah.
I really didn't think of that configuration, so I put three people together. And what would be the who gets along with whom and who? Who forms an alliance? Cal and Con are in an alliance against Beth. And if Cal wants to get at Beth, one thing he does is to do things with Con. They get along well, and that bugs her. If Con wants to bug his mother, why, he can team up with his dad. And it's kind of like getting the other person to do your fighting for you in some ways. But at least two against one, and we have a better chance. Pardon?
Beth Buck.
Yes. Beth and Buck, we didn't see it, but it was reported to us. They got along marvelously well. And then, let's see, and then you would have how, Elmer, with Con?
From where it was when we saw him, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that what we saw, there was conflict here. Yeah, the one guy who got in the car and said the three of us were best pals at an earlier time, and from that scene they got along well. So there was some of both. There was a conflict that we saw in the movie. There were times when they got along. Let's see. I was thinking a triangle was Beth and Buck got along well, but whereas Cal didn't get on Con's case, he apparently was after Buck quite a bit. So you've got a perfect balance in that way of one youngster with one parent, and everybody's kind of teamed up. Okay, triangles. That's one of the contributions of Murray Bowen, to look at a family in terms of triangles and alliances. And he leans on a little geometry and saying, well, triangles are non-collapsible figures. They're the strongest geometric figure, and they really are the strongest emotional configuration in a family. And to break triangles is pretty difficult. You don't do it unless the participants in the triangle let go. From the outside, they don't break. Okay, last week, in terms of the family, talked about or presented roles. What are some family roles? People, individuals in a family can function in what ways?
Authority, nurturer.
Okay, the person who provides nurturing, authority figure, discipline. It has sub-roles, disciplinarian. It's like police and judge. Typically, mom catches you doing it and dad punishes you. You know, dad passes sentence and punishes you. Mom catches you doing it. What others?
Peacemaker.
Peacemaker, okay. Who is typically a peacemaker?
Mother.
Okay.
In this case, father.
Yeah, one child tends to be a peacemaker. John said what?
In this case, the father.
Okay, Cal seemed to come across as peacemaker. The family, let's see, birth order rules all, or family ties, chapter 7, talks about peacemakers as typically being identified with a middle child. Middle child, because of their position in the family, they learn to be to do arbitration. They have to contend with older siblings as well as younger siblings and keep peace, that role. Middle children tend to be good negotiators. You know, tend to be. You know, all the stuff is tend to be statistical, and there's always exceptions to the rule, and there are always extenuating circumstances that shape it. Say the middle child is a male figure, and older and younger are both sisters, or all sisters. Who the middle child is also shaped by who's the male model in that system. You know, what kind of a person is father. So I don't mean to make it overly simplistic, just to present. Disciplinarian, nurturer, peacemaker, what are some other roles?
Black sheep.
Okay, black sheep. The person who carries the family's sin. If there is sickness in the family, Fritz was talking about, the family walks in and says, we are sick, and the question is, well, where do you feel it the most? It's not the typical scene in this culture, and he was alluding to a different culture. The scene here is be healthy, be young, be strong. Be on top of things, be in charge, have a good appearance. So if there is sickness in the family system, if somewhere it is sick, somebody, some one member gets identified as the black sheep and carries the guilt and the sin of the whole system. The adolescent who is most rebellious, the person who doesn't get along with other people in the family, the one who runs away, the one who is an alcoholic or drug problems or school problems, you know, the person who is sick, and when the family brings that person to the therapist to fix that person, it's another instance of the dynamics of the mobile, whatever somebody might do to fix that person. If that person really does start functioning better, whatever that means, the family will sabotage, ambush, undermine the improvement in that individual because the role that that person was playing for the whole family's well-being. So very soon on, you know, who's the identified patient? The family identifies an individual, but where really is the problem? You want to read, it's like a novel, an illustration of that. Carl Whitaker is one of the more aggressive people in family therapy. And he teamed up with Carl Whitaker, or Carl Whitaker teamed up with, Augustus Napier teamed up with Carl Whitaker, and then Napier wrote this book of their work with a family. And you go through the whole session, and it's not an academic book. You go through the sessions, and Napier say, you know, so-and-so says this, and so-and-so says that, and we said this because. So it's commentary, but it's written up like a novel, not like a dialogue. So they come in with an adolescent and who is the identified patient. But what happens is that, like a house is built on a foundation, if the foundation is crooked, the whole house is crooked. It's tilted. It's askew. So the parents, mother and father, husband and wife, in a family relationship are like the foundation for the house. And after a few sessions, the youngsters drop out, and they are allowed to drop out of this family therapy, and the two therapists are working with mom and dad. Then the kids come back in on occasion. They even have a gathering of grandparents. You know, you get a whole bunch of people together to see the whole system. But the problem wasn't with the presenting, the identified patient. The problem was in the marriage relationship. Okay, what other roles do you see in a family?
Successful person.
Okay, the one who is our star, mm-hmm. our hero, the one who is successful, accomplishes a great deal, wins trophies, gets lots of letters after their name, many diplomas. What else?
The baby.
Okay, the joker, the humorist, the one who brings some spontaneity and life and gaiety. And can, the humorist and the peacemaker might be together. Yeah. And so the peacemaker in diffusing the a tense situation can do so perhaps with humor. Alana?
The baby, or the person that everyone takes care of.
Okay. Yeah, the baby in the family. And mothers frequently say of their 35-year-old youngest child, this is my baby, you know. Well, something about roles is that as we grow up, we see how our parents model certain roles. And parents of the same sex, it is, we see that as a role model to follow. We also look at the labels that get attached to us, the roles that we are defined by, and then we tend to function that way. It becomes part of our self-identity. So the class clown in first grade, the person who gets that label, why, the first day of school in second grade, everybody looks over to them, you know, waiting for that funny to come from them, that joke. By the time they're in the fourth or fifth grade, and people have labeled them that way and stereotype them that way and relate to them that way, and then they, you know, by the fourth or fifth grade, they start seeing themselves or wanting to see themselves as more than just class clown. They have a real identity struggle. But we label people and then we relate to the label, which is such a small part of who the person is. But roles are tremendously powerful in the shaping of who we are and how we see who we are. Well, okay, we could say yet more about roles, but I want to I'd like to cover a little more ground before break. Rules. Rules take many shapes in a family system. Some of them are explicit, some of them are told directly. I suspect most of them aren't. And especially in a family that is systemically pathological, a family that is not functioning well. They say they're not functioning well, and others look at them and say, good grief, I'm glad I'm not part of that family, and I want to stay away from them if I can. So I'm leaving the specifics of the term healthy and functioning well loose. But in families where the functioning is more problematic, the rules are less explicit. And not only are they less explicit, but they're not being accessible even means they are non-negotiable. They are inflexible. So we don't even know what the rules are. We don't have access to them. We can't change them. So it's a very fixed, rigid system, and that's part of their stuckness. And I think, does this family have a last name?
Jarrett.
What?
Jarrett. J-A-R-R-E-T-T.
Okay, Jarrett. Mm-hmm. Jarrett. You know, they were really stuck. Mm-hmm. And Khan's attempt at suicide is some indication of that, an attempt to get out of it. And his working with Berger finally does loosen things up, and there gets to be some space so that some newness can come in. But left to their own, they're very stuck. Rules weren't talked about, per se. And each person didn't talk to the other person about their ways of relating, per se. Rules, some ways of accessing the family rules would be to... you think of your own family and think of an animal. You know, what animal does your family bring to mind? And how do you make that connection? What does that animal symbolize? Or pick a food. You know, imagery with some metaphor. If you were to draw a coat of arms for your family, what would you draw on the coat of arms? How would you depict it? And if you had a saying, a logo for your family, what would be the family saying? And last week I said, well, over the weekend, think about some of your family sayings. You know, I think the one that stands out most strongly for me is, and I claim that my dad said this, but it was a family saying. If you're going to do something, do it right. And I live under a tremendous threat that I'm going to do something and it's not going to be right. You know, it has to be right. And taken to the nth degree, of course, it has to be perfect. And not only right, but eternally right. So it's a capital R. Right with a capital R. Criticism is very difficult to take because it means I did something wrong. You know, there's some... if you're going to do it right. Well, that's no biggie. I mean, if somebody says that, that's not going to cripple or crush somebody. But if over the course of, say, 18 years, you hear that, say, just twice a week, you know, 4 weeks a month, 12 months a year, or 18 years, the point I'm making is these things get ingrained subtly, slowly. They are etched in, and they become norms by which we live. So I remember having to go see the counselor in junior high school, and she says, well, your problem, Bob, is you're a perfectionist. Well, that was the first time anybody attached that label to me, and I couldn't understand what she meant because she said it was my problem, and I didn't think it was a problem. I thought, well, if I do it right, that's good. And she's saying, but that's a problem. And I'm saying, thinking to myself, lady, I don't know where you're coming from. You're out. You haven't talked to my dad. Family rules disclosed through family sayings. What were some of those family sayings you... Yeah, almost a double bind.
She didn't take over and do it. She let us go ahead and do it, but grumbled about it.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been easier to do.
Mm-hmm. Martyr is another role that family martyrs. Thank you.
Well, it comes to my mind is that's my tail, you sit on yours.
And to you, that means what?
I don't know. Confusion. I don't know what that means. I finally figured out what he was saying after a while, but I guess that's the way I do things. You do it your way. You know, it's my tail, you sit on yours.
It's my tail, you sit on yours. Okay. I was thinking it sounded similar to stand on your own feet.
Yeah, or whatever you're coming from, you know.
Yeah.
Something that comes to mind for me is in our front hall for many years we've had this long homemade thing that my mom got, and she could only laugh and shake her head. There's 8 different shells on it with 2 little eyes on each, and it says, "Sometimes I think we're all nuts." And she sort of greets people like,
"Sometimes I think we're all nuts." Yeah. So how do people in the family perceive that?
Well, maybe it's kind of nervous laughter or something.
Yeah, a nervous laughter. Many a truth in jest is said, or she really thinks we're nuts, huh? What were some others? I think somebody had a hand up over here. Family saying.
They'd say, "Well, I might as well go talk to the wall and get more response."
Yeah.
Parents would have kids.
Parents would say that to
whoever they were talking to, the kids or each other.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I know when I say to my parents, "You talk too much." My mother especially. Really disrespectful, but that's why
You talk too much.
Yeah, you talk too much. And I talk a whole lot. I have not much nerve to say that.
You know? Yeah. We had a saying up on our wall which said, "What is important is not to do great things, but to do healthy things," or something like that. But actually, I think it was more a reminder for my father, because he actually wanted to do great things if he could.
And what kind of things were healthy things?
I guess rather to be very ambitious about what you did and get fame for it or whatever. It was more important that you thought about in the little things that you did, that you brought about that sound or a healthy way of thinking and living,
okay.
So on that. Yeah. What was important was all the little things and how you went about the little things in daily life.
That healthy in a holistic way, not just in medicine.
Oh no.
Type of thing.
Yeah. If I should try to think about something different, I would think, but always try to do your best. And what comes to mind, but if I did a test in school and if my parents knew that I had studied very hard and done what I could, and if I didn't maybe succeed as much as I wanted, then my dad always said, "Well, you did your best, you did as good as you could." It was always encouraging. And with other things, if I try to do something like, for example, sports and so on, well, you did your best and so on. What I see now is a very good thing. Very much support in that. They knew that I did actually do that.
I think the rules I can remember were unspoken and mostly positive. The making up and the hugging and the public kissing and stuff like that were all good ones. The one I remember in words though was, "You'll never learn any younger." And the way I remember it is, take a crack at it, you know, see what you could do. So it was a positive one too. If you were scared, try, see what happens.
I think one of the positive things in my family was the support for learning. I think that was there always. Especially from my father, that was big number one thing, education. And although it's never said this, you know, I certainly got rewarded financially. I got extra bucks, you know, when I was going to school. I think that's why I'm still going to school, you know, by being there and just trying. And the academics, I think that was very important. It's never been said, but verbalized, but I know that's a big thing. And I think it's a good thing for me. I think it's about the only way to get me to do something, you know, it seems like. Very, so.
We have someone too that stand out for me, and they're unspoken too, more like what Elma was saying, but it was, we'll love you no matter what. No matter what, we'll love you. But then the other one that sort of contradicted that was, don't stir up the burnt part on the bottom.
Oh.
You know, if you're cooking something, if you burn it a little bit, just take it off the top. Mm-hmm. It's okay, but don't stir up the dust either.
Yeah, that's a nice thing about sayings. You know, you can use the one that you want to use to get whatever point you want to make at the time. So you'll hear somebody say, maybe related to yours, Elmer, is he who hesitates is lost. You know, go ahead and make the plunge. Then the other side of that is, well, look before you leap. Well, you know, if you get both of those, it's damned if you do and damned if you don't. You gotta watch it. Yeah. Okay, another aspect here. We, you know, there's lots more about rules. This is an introduction anyway. Rituals as another way of accessing the family and identifying, well, what is the balance that this mobile is at? What's homeostasis? Who are we? And how do we relate with each other, and how do we function? Lots of ways of getting at rituals. One that came to my mind, John, when you were talking about school and it being important, a ritual is names. Look at people's first name and look at the middle name, and where did their name come from? Who had that name, and what does that symbolize? You know, and if the oldest child, let's say the oldest son, has the middle name of great-great-grandfather back here, well, what did that person do? What were they known for? What did they accomplish? Or what was so significant that that name keeps going on? May not be first name, but middle name. Who's the first person to graduate from college in the family system, and where does that name occur, and does it carry very slight connotations of, we expect you to grow up and graduate from college too, you know, to be that great person, to write that book, to make that discovery, to be a doctor. And I think in our culture that may be a bit stronger with guys than with girls.
That's an interesting thought, and I'm sure that sometimes that's true. But as I think back in our family, it wasn't the idea that you even, at least, weren't even aware that there was something distinguishing why. It was just that it's nice if one of the children has grandma's name on one side, and next time another child will have the middle name of grandma on the other side, sort of thing. So maybe what you just said last, maybe it's more characteristic in the males, because I'm thinking of grandma's name here rather than.
Yeah, it's real slippery, you know, and the way to present it makes it sound clear and black and white. My middle name is George, my mother's father's name is George, and I know very little about George explicitly, you know. But what do we give George, you know, for Christmas, for birthdays? How do we relate to that person? What kind of unarticulated expectations are there that I don't even know about, but it's been shaping my life for, you know, how many years. Hey, Elmer?
Yeah, see, my mom did that. My mom was really great years old. And all the first three kids were all named like that. I have three relatives' names on that business. And the first one comes from a really bad relative. I can't stand but when she got to her last one, she went to a phone book, pointed three places and named the kid. Got tired of all this. Vernon Lester Merrill came strictly out of the phone book. Nothing to do with anything.
Yeah. But what kind of, you know, what kind of significance or meaning does that carry for that child whose three older siblings have family names and they have phone book names? I mean, it's not a matter of, well, what is it in some reality sense, some ontological way, but how does that youngster perceive it? You know.
He does perceive it very well. He likes the Egyptian.
Yeah.
Close in balance.
Rituals through names. Another thing to say is, well, what nationality, what culture is behind Howard? Mm-hmm. What's behind Ellie? What's behind Cal's parents? And where did Cal grow up? What was his family doing? And in what part of the country did Cal grow up and Beth grow up? And, you know, were they stable? Did they move a lot? You know, what sort of rituals and expectations go with that heritage, that cultural heritage? And how do you see it evolve itself in annual family rituals? Somebody mentioned with the word family, holidays. How does this family celebrate Christmas? And if they have a big dinner Christmas Eve, I think that's Swedish, and open Christmas packages, Christmas Eve, or gifts, and this family is, we go to church Christmas morning and then open gifts, and they get married, how is this family going to celebrate, observe Christmas?
Well, that works out perfect. Then you can go to that Christmas family, Christmas Eve, and then Christmas Day.
You can open gifts before
yeah,
right after.
Yeah. But if you go here, you know, what do you open and what don't you open? And it has to be negotiated.
Right.
Okay, if you can negotiate it, if the rules can be explicit, you know, that's functioning well. But if the assumption is, because it's so ingrained and so unexamined and unreflected upon, that opening Christmas gifts Christmas Day is wrong, you know, you're supposed to open them all Christmas Eve, then there's a tremendous amount of agitation when we go over here. And if she clings fastidiously to the way it was in this family, then doing anything like that Christmas Eve is inappropriate and it's wrong and I'm not comfortable then and we shouldn't be doing this, you know, and well, okay, we're going to do it because we have to do it, but I don't like it. And, you know, real pleasant. Real pleasant.
Let's celebrate Christmas.
Well, other rituals, birthdays. When a couple comes in, I say, well, you know, we make this genogram. I say, well, next time bring pictures of your family. You know, go to the wedding and I'll kind of know who's who. And it's sort of interesting to see what kind of pictures they bring in. And they like to bring in pictures and tell stories that are related with pictures. And this one gal brought in pictures, a whole bunch of pictures of her family. Every single one of them was of a birthday party. And the relatives who were there were out of town. They were out of state. But everybody went to everybody's birthday party. Can you imagine what birthday parties are like in that family? And, you know, what's this guy in for when he's not ready to make the travels out of town and things for people's birthdays? That's a real setup for problems.